Let us pray. O Great Spirit, move among us, within us, and around us, if necessary, that your kingdom might come and your will be done, according to your living word this day. Amen. A reading from the book of Judges, chapter 16. Samson fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The lords of the Philistines came to her and said to her, "Coax him and find out what makes his strength so great, and how we may overpower him, and that we may bind him in order to subdue him, and we will give you each 1,100 pieces of silver." So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me what makes your strength so great, and how you could be bound so that one could subdue you." Samson said to her, "If they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that are not dried out, then I shall become weak and be like anyone else." Then the lords of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not dried out, and she bound him with them. While men were lying in wait in an inner chamber, she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he snapped the bowstrings, as a strand of fiber snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Then Delilah said to Samson, "You have mocked me and told lies. Please tell me how you could be bound." He said to her, "If they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like anyone else." So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." The men lying in wait were in an inner chamber. But he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Don't you want to know how it ends? Then Delilah said to Samson, "Oh, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me 3 times now and have not told me what makes your strength so great." Finally, after she had nagged him with her words day after day and pestered him, he was tired to death. So he told her his whole secret, and he said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, then my strength would leave me. I would become weak and would be like anyone else." Then Delilah realized that he had told her his whole secret. And she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "The time has come up, for he has told his whole secret to me." And then the lords of the Philistines came up to her, and they brought money into their hands. And she let him fall asleep on her lap. And she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. He began to weaken, and his strength left him. And then she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And when he awoke from his sleep, he thought, "I will go out, as at other times, and shake myself free." but he did not know that the Lord had left him. So the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, and they brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze shackles, and he ground at the mill in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. This ends the reading. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. These Samson stories are designed to go viral. No matter what else you think about them, I think we can agree they have all of the ingredients of contagious storytelling: secrets, sex, intrigue, violence, betrayal. It's no wonder that the poster on your bulletin looks like Pulp Fiction. A hero with enormous potential and even bigger flaws, a tragic conclusion worthy of the Greek gods. These are wild and amazing stories from the Bible, and not a single one of them is included in our lectionary. So if your understanding of the Bible is largely defined by the sanitized canon of texts that we tend to preach from week to week, you may not know much about Samson or the entire book of Judges, for that matter. But like most viral stories, the Samson stories have a way of getting around the censors. I, for one, relied upon them as a desperately bored teenager, forced by my parents to sit through endless worship services with their droning sermons and their seven-verse hymns. I entertained myself by doing things like counting the pages of the hymnal until I found the exact middle. And then when that was over, I would troll through the Old Testament, finding the most salacious and outrageous stories: the two adulterous sisters of Ezekiel, Balaam's talking donkey, Ehud, the evil king who was assassinated while using the restroom. I eventually located and read all of these stories with delight, all while looking like the most devout member of the youth group. Take notes, high schoolers. Believe it or not, sometimes the most interesting thing in the room is happening in your Bibles. Anyway, Samson makes a strong impression on young people, which is precisely what was intended. To really understand the book of Judges, where these stories live, you have to understand that they are, in their most ancient form, folk tales. They are campfire stories told at dusk with great fanfare, legends passed down from generation to generation. The book of Judges tells stories from what was known as the era of Judges, this ambiguous adolescent period between the Exodus and the era of kings, roughly 200 years between 1200 BC and 1000 BC. So if the Exodus tells the story of the journey from slavery to freedom in the promised land, Judges tells the messy next chapter, the inconvenient truth that the promised land was already inhabited by a lot of other people. And if you can imagine, the Israelite people were not yet a nation. They didn't have an army. They were more like a constellation of family groups. So they made alliances and enemies with their various neighbors. They sometimes intermarried with other tribes. They bought and sold goods from each other. They were just trying to make it work. And one thing that has to be kept in mind is that between the tribal wars and the intermarriage, the Jewish people were constantly afraid of disappearing, that their people and their faith would dissolve into this Mesopotamian melting pot, never to be seen again. You can feel this anxiety running through the book of Judges. And the judges themselves were not really judges at all. They were really more like folk heroes, freedom fighters even, who got a reputation for standing up for the Israelite people in a very uncertain time. No, these stories were designed to go viral, to lodge in the minds of young people, to give them hope and courage. When you despair, they might say, remember the wisdom of Deborah, the cunning of Gideon, the strength of Samson. So that's the first layer of the story of Samson. Samson, the folk hero. Kids love it. But there is another layer to this story, a theological cross current that has to be told if we're going to understand Samson, the anti-hero. The other side of this story involves the editor of the text, a person whose true name is unknown, but we call him the Deuteronomic editor. Let's just call him Ed. Ed is the theoretical person who theoretically composed the book of Judges. So while the stories of Judges take place in 1200 BC, most scholars now agree that Ed actually composed the book much later, like 600 years later, 600 BC. So Ed knows some things that are influencing how he pieces the story together. He knows, for example, that the era of Judges ended very badly, that the tribes of Israel become more violent and more extreme and end up fighting each other. He knows that Israel, this nation charged by God to be holy, is dissolved into so many different kinds of sin that they cease to be recognizable. He knows that they eventually demand a king so that they can be like the other nations. And he knows that their kings, although some were better than others, could not stop Jerusalem from being destroyed by the Babylonians. In 587 BC, the temple and the city are destroyed. The Israelite people are scattered across the region. And that is the dark moment when Ed picks up his pen and begins to compose the book of Judges. And what he does, this clever editor, is really fascinating to me, because he takes the heroes of the Israelite people, the folk stories that everybody knew by heart, and he weaves them into this larger narrative of a people wandering away from God. So as you might imagine, the effect of this strategy is very subversive and might help explain that queasy feeling you might feel in your stomach when you encounter Samson, the folk hero, the oversexed buffoon, Israel's great hope, murderer of thousands, champion of the people, sex addict, martyr, terrorist. In short, he is the quintessential biblical anti-hero. He is the best of times, and he is the worst of times. Samson's birth story will probably sound familiar to you. His mother had been childless for many years, to her dismay. But one day she was visited by an angel who gave her good news that she would soon give birth to a very special son. He was to be different from other children. He would be holy and set apart. He would never cut his hair. He would never drink alcohol. He would be the one to begin to deliver the Israelite people. There are hints here, obviously, of Isaac, son of Sarah, and Samuel, son of Hannah. There are hints of Mary and Gabriel and, of course, Jesus. Samson was to be one of the greats, one of the saviors of the Israelite people. And it is, indeed, without a doubt, he was different than other people. He was incredibly strong, and repeatedly the book of Judges says that the Spirit of the Lord was with him. His physical strength and fearlessness gave him a reputation as a great defender of the people. This is the folk hero that everyone remembered. But Judges also won't let us forget about his impulsive appetite for power, his obsessive lust, his foolish love. He was associated romantically with three different Philistine women, even as he killed hundreds of Philistine men. His actions were almost never governed by thought or prayer or principle. He was led by his gut. As one commentary puts it, Samson is what happens when weak people receive power instead of growing powerful. He had the strength to exert control over other people and no ability to control himself. And we don't get too much information about Delilah, only that she was a woman from Sarek and that Samson was in love with her. Her name is Semitic, but she was likely a Philistine just like his other lovers. She may have very well loved Samson too, but in the end, she took the money and she set about betraying him to his enemies. And now it's easy to point out the obvious that Samson seems incredibly dumb to allow himself to be manipulated by Delilah no less than four times before he's captured. What were you thinking? You might want to cry out. But then again, that might be the same comment you make to your friend who returns to an abusive relationship again and again. The same comment you might make to your brother who has promised for the umpteenth time that he is done drinking. The same comment you might make to yourself when you just can't stop yourself from saying that thing that you know is going to wound a person that you love. Yes, Samson seems incredibly dumb, but this is the stuff of sin. We do exactly what we know we should not. Samson has incredible power, but he binds it to all the wrong things, and the results are devastating. There are a lot of reasons why these stories didn't make the lectionary. For one, they don't work well as religious propaganda. This is a messy, sordid story that doesn't roll up into a tidy, moral takeaway. If anything, it's demoralizing. The mighty Samson ends his own life by knocking down the temple of the Philistine god Dagon, killing 3,000 other people at the same time. He is the original religious suicide bomber, killing in the name of a holy war. It's horrific. But today's text in particular, we steer away from it in worship because it's complex, and also because who wants to field questions in the family van about why Samson allowed himself to be tied up on your way to post-worship lunch? But if we stop painting Samson as a hero and let him be the anti-hero I think he is, we can see this story as an incredible parable about power and vulnerability. Because part of what makes Samson so tragic is that from the beginning, he has this gifted future. He's got parents who love him, a God who has proclaimed him as chosen and given him incredible strength. But rather than seeing himself as a signpost pointing to the grace and love of God, he very quickly begins wielding his power in the service of his own ego, his own appetite. He accepts the dominant cultural narrative that power is for possessing rather than for serving. And in the end, his downfall comes packaged as one more thing he simply wants to possess. And he is so used to having what he wants, he doesn't even see the danger until it's too late. This is not the story of Samson who made the mistake of engaging in premarital sex, although it is certainly often painted that way. This is the story of a man who was driven by a hunger for love, but has no idea how to be vulnerable in ways that make for love. Now, the Deuteronomic editor seems to be whispering in the margins of the text. Now, what if Samson serves as something of a metaphor for Israel? A gifted, chosen people set aside for greatness, set aside to demonstrate the truth of who God is. A people who hunger for love of God and love of neighbor, but nonetheless bind themselves again and again to the idols of their culture. A people who wield power as a way to possess and control their neighbor, a people who see violence as a path to righteousness. Can't you see, the book of Judges seems to whisper, can't you see that this project is doomed? Can't you see, the book seems to say without saying, that this is a dangerous exercise in missing the point? As a folk hero, Samson is a dangerous one. He sells the mythology of redemptive violence. He is a symbol of might makes right, bolstered by the intoxicating idea of God's will. And sadly, I don't have to remind you of how relevant that particular religious poison remains in our world. So how genius is it then that the book of Judges carefully diffuses that bomb by letting the story play out to its own tragic end? On Wednesday evening of this week, two Palestinian men walked into a cafe in Tel Aviv. They were dressed as Orthodox Jews, black suits, white shirts, and they lingered at a table briefly before firing guns concealed in their bags, killing four Israelis, wounding several others. And this attack is just the latest round of violence between Israelis and Palestinians that has killed 12 Israelis, two Americans, and 200 Palestinians since last October. The story of the attack shocked me for several reasons. Maybe most obviously, I just returned from Tel Aviv. I walked through that shopping district. So it feels a little bit too real in that way. But even more so, it shocked me because I've been thinking all week about Samson. I've been thinking about this tragic story of a man with God-gifted power who then worshiped power as though it were God. The gunmen disguise themselves as Orthodox Jews who are easy to spot because they do not cut their hair, as they believe it is a sin. Israel and Palestine are deadlocked in this conflict over a land that they believe should be theirs and theirs alone. Now, there are those who would say that religion is at the heart of the problem. They would say we must root out zealots by rooting out religion itself. And I can certainly see where they are coming from. But I hardly think that the problem here is religion. The problem here is our human nature. We are foolish to project this onto the Middle East or any religious group. I mean, look at Orlando. Look at Baltimore City. It's a sin of our nature bound to us in ways that we can scarcely even see. To the extent that religion cuts deep into our hearts and into our identities as humans, it has the power to fan the flames of violence, and it has the power to heal us. It is so important that we as people of faith continue to claim that healing power for the world, to continue to claim that idea that God has the whole world in God's hands. As troubling as some of these Old Testament texts can be, I do find solace in the subtle but growing critique in the book of Judges. There is an increasingly urgent cry from the people of God for a new way of being the church, and it is no less relevant today than it ever was. But we do not rally around Samson, or David, or Solomon, or Herod, or Caesar. We don't rally around the military might of the United States of America or the almighty dollar. We don't rally around a fundamentalist ideology of God. We gather today around the table of Jesus Christ, a baby born to a woman who could scarcely contain her joy, a baby born holy, a prince of peace, a child who would grow into a man of great power, a man of great power who time and again crossed boundaries of race and gender and class and ability, not to incite hate, but to incite love, a man who poured out his power into a cup of suffering love so that we might not miss the point of what it means to follow God. We follow that one. God knows we lose our way, but we follow